I was a high school student in the 50s, and I can remember once as a high school student going through the South on a bus, and I had left my seat at one of the stops, and I've never told this story before because it's really bothered me, but I had some books and things I just left out on the seat because I'd saved my seat, you know, and just put all the stuff out on the seat. Well, I came back and there was this very large woman sitting there, right on my books. And I didn't know what to do, you know. But the bus driver came up and told her to move. She was a black woman, okay? And that stuck with me, and I realized later I knew it then in a way, that woman had a lot of courage to come sit, because it was in the front of the seat, the front of the bus. And I'm sure she wasn't meaning on sitting on my books, but she was probably scared, because that was an act. And the bus driver wasn't clearing my seat out, because I had that seat. She was being told to move to the back. That was the way it was. And I can remember it. I can remember going into, those who weren't in the South, or, and it was in the North, it wasn't that much better. And separate water fountains, separate restrooms, usually blacks around the back. And you'd see in the bus stops, just the whites. And blacks would be off in one little back room. That's where they had to go. I graduated from college in 1961. And I was reading in the paper, a couple years after that, a story about the Val Victorian in my class. And I went to the Virginia Military Institute, school in the South. And the Val Victorian in my class had gone down. He had been studying to become a Episcopal minister. And he and a seminary student from Catholic, he was studying to become a priest, went down, I think it was to Selma, Alabama, and their purpose was to try to bring the communities together after the TV cameras had left. And they killed him. And they shot him. And then they had a trial and they acquitted him. I mean, that's what was happening. I think John Daniels was his name. I don't know if any of you heard of Jonathan Daniels. But it made an impact, I think, on the South. Because if you know the South, VMI is considered rather, you know, prestigious in the South. And he had been a graduate of VMI, and the Southerners had to think about what was going on. Well, at the end of the 60s, things had changed. And the life now is different between those 50s and those 60s. And I pick up my alumni news now from the Virginia Military Institute, and there's pictures of black alumni now, and officers in the alumni club, and cadet officers, not just athletes. And that's a change, And the 60s were a painful period. But for that blatant segregation that was there, and to get rid of it, I think that alone, if the 60s are known for, and if they make us more sensitive to that, I think the 60s, you know, have a good mark on history, even though it was a painful period. So those are a few of the experiences I had over that period of time. Somebody want to share some others?
Well,
observations?
They did call that the smoking 60s.
Yeah.
Because Watts was burning in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. Cleveland, Ohio was burning, even Washington, D.C. was set
That's
on
right.
fire.
That's
so
right.
It was really a critical time.
And it was such a contrast from the 50s. Remember in the 50s, everything was so nice? Mm-hmm. At least that's what I had. Everything was, you know, the happy days, like, you know. But it wasn't, obviously. It wasn't.
Who was president? Eisenhower was president.
Eisenhower was president.
Right? In the 60s.
Well, at the end,
60.
Yeah, he.
Then Kennedy.
Right, 60. I think 1960 was the transition, And then there was Kennedy, and then, of course, Kennedy was shot, and then there was Johnson.
We had a joyous period in 69. Two of our sons were in service. One had voluntarily joined the Army for 3 years. He joined 1 year before his younger brother was drafted into a 2-year service. The older brother had, through quite a circumstance of experience, studied finance, but through a complicated procedure in Germany, he didn't get assigned by the time he arrived there, not due to his own fault, but his position had been taken. So he was assigned on howitzers, big guns, and he was very bitter, but we told him to remain calm. Meanwhile, his younger brother had gone through infantry training in Georgia, Fort Benning, and was to be a sergeant in infantry. Both of these boys had their basic at Fort Lewis, Washington. The younger brother was assigned down to California and was about to board a plane for Vietnam when his older brother volunteered from Germany to go to Vietnam. Now, they're not allowed to have two brothers in Vietnam at the same time. So this is about the time Paul was to go aboard this plane down in Frisco to head for Nam, when Dave landed at Da Nang in Vietnam. This canceled the infantry brother. He came back to Fort Lewis and went to Korea. The older brother then was in finance in a well-protected 23rd Infantry headquarters. Saw only one attack in the whole year he was there. But I'm convinced in my own mind that he saved the life of his younger brother by the move he made from Germany to Vietnam. The joyous occasion in our life in 69, both came back out of the service, 4 days apart, first week of December.
One day apart,
first week of December, just before Christmas. And so we really
What a Christmas. What a Christmas. Wow, that's really special. Okay, other stories.
What was the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated? 68. It was, the day after that, a group of us from the town where I live, the suburb of Chicago, and with our League of Women Voters, and we had a field trip planned a long time for this day, and it was to visit a school, an educational project in the black section of Chicago. And so we went ahead. We realized that things wouldn't be normal because of, we got the word early that morning what had happened. And we knew things wouldn't be normal, and some of us felt that we really wanted to have some kind of, or attend a memorial service somewhere that day, because Martin Luther King had meant a lot to a number of us. And so we went ahead with our plan, did the carpooling and everything to go down to this place, and we visited in the school, but then the parents council was meeting that day too, and they had a memorial service that they just planned in an impromptu fashion, and it was not a formal thing at all. But each one of us then went around the room, black parents and the white people from this suburb were all there together, feeling and sharing their loss at the same time, each one of us telling what this had meant to us. And it was very moving. Then we had a prayer. The school principal who came from our suburb, appeared at the door. He went to the door because there was this loud noise outside, and we didn't know what was going on. He went to the door, and when he came back in, there was a spot on his cheek. And we learned later that he had been hit with a stone, because the whole neighborhood was upset. I mean, naturally, they would be. And there was a big crowd marching down the street. And he said, I want every child to stay in school. I don't want anybody to leave. And he said, I don't want you people to leave for a while, because he said, you just don't dare go out. This neighborhood is too upset. And so we stayed there for a while. And one group was, because they had their car parked in a place that they could get to it and they could get out, they left. And I was in a car that was parked across from where this mob was coming down the street. So they said, well, you'll have to wait. You can't go across to get in that car. So the leader in his parents' council, who happened to be a minister, and he was black, but I think that was the reason he was there that day. He didn't go to work because he was a minister, and he could schedule his time differently. And so he was there, and he said, I'll take you home in my car, and then we'll get your car later. And that's what he drove us all the way out to the suburb. And then later on, he delivered the other car. Did it himself, so that we were, but on the way out, we were talking this over, and it was a heavy load for all of us. We were feeling something like guilt, you know, and he was trying to relieve us of this, and he said, you have to remember, said, there is no redemption without the shedding of blood. Mm-hmm. That's wow. Heavy, but it's...
That's heavy.
It's true.
Wow. Yeah, the contrast of the 50s and the 60s for me.
Yeah.
And I know that I am a different person because of Martin Luther King, because he, more than anyone else, I think, symbolized, I think, the good part of the 60s, the strength, and yet the commitment to peace and nonviolence, and the Christian gospel.
Exactly.
And there was a lot of turmoil, but somehow he was through that, and the courage of those people, you know, because they, you know, people like Martin Luther King were being criticized from their own people, blacks and the whites. It was a hard time.
I think it's only in through the perspective now of years that people see him as a hero that he
right.
was to many of us at that time.
Right.
But
right.
I think to others, they're realizing it too.
Yeah. I mean, the contrast in the 50s and the 60s is just so perfect.
In our suburb, we had a human relations council that was devoted, it was an all-white suburb, to try to change attitudes, and with some success, and we invited Dr. Martin Luther King out it was less than a year before he died, and spoke in the college, and the mayor of the city made it a point to come back from his vacation to introduce him, which we thought was a great coup, you know, and we filled the auditorium, it's a Christian college. But the thing I remember then, he was shocked, was that evening as we were standing there, I was presiding, I was the chairman of the council, singing "We Shall Overcome," Coretta King on my, you know, on one side of me.
Oh, wow.
And every time I see Coretta King on TV, I remember how moving it was to be standing there with Martin and Coretta on the platform.
Wow, that's fantastic.
In Elmhurst, Illinois. Elmhurst College permitted us to use the auditorium. We filled it. Not good publicity. It was a good thing.
Living history, you see?
Well, and our oldest son was one of the volunteers that went down to Mississippi.
He went down twice.
To register voters. And we you know, we felt like you did about the things that he, the stories that he came back with. The lynchings were common.
Yeah. I really didn't real. It didn't hit me home until here was a person I knew that was shot down.
Yeah.
You know, you read in the newspapers, and you're always reading about, you know, somebody shoots somebody, and you begin to not think much about it. But it was real.
So the day after he came home, the police car went by the house. He just automatically dropped to the floor. Mm. And then we looked at him and says, "I just haven't gotten over the habit yet." That's how scary it was to work. We've been down there all summer. We've been down in spring, then we're down in summer. The stories you get in the newspaper reports, the TV just never told the whole story.
Other story.
He said too that the North had its problems too. He said we discriminate in more subtle ways, but they're open about it.
And they've improved more than the North.
I think the South.
People predicted that. They said the South will be integrated before the North. And I think that's coming true.
Very true.
Judy. Oh, that's great. Thanks.
Well, I came to Washington, D.C. in 1937, and I've been there ever since. And Caroline left in 44. So we've gone through, we've experienced much of what happened in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
I remember the first was Andrew singing in front of the Lincoln Memorial. I remember that. That was a very moving thing. And the first time I mingled on the streets just with black and white together, all dressed up, just as quietly singing, going down the Constitution Avenue. And then the other, all the turmoil of the other years, there's so many things that happened. We became very much involved in the Poor People's Campaign. And our church just didn't seem to want to cooperate. There were just a few of us who were going to other churches. But I painted more signs. We had people in our house. We had blacks filled with people, young people staying overnight, and hauling clothes and food and back and forth. We had a van. And I painted more signs and placards. 20 years ago, we just celebrated last Saturday that March on Washington. When I was there, I heard Dr. King give that talk too.
Oh, wow.
We were members of the Human Relations Association.
Yes, sir.
Well, I assumed you were.
I'm the original board.
I assumed that. I've been a member of those seminars. And so I painted the big banner for the Human Relations 20 years ago because we carried the parade. And just before we came out, I painted the other one that we were at the company's anniversary of 20 years. I'd like to just tell one of the gooey things that I think I've ever experienced in these years. That's the Vietnam thing. We had there again all the demonstrations, tearing candles. I walked around the Capitol 7 times and we thought the walls were very cool. And Jesse Jackson was running around there in the turmoil around the agriculture building. I was a witness to just real violence there in front of the intersection at one time. But I remember one fellow came up to me. I was sketching up on the steps there. It was so moving to me to see these vans, these police vans, and they were trying to cross the street. I saw this policeman just beat that poor black man. And so I was standing up there alone. He says, "Come on, you have to join the crowd, join the crowd." I couldn't go back any farther. The wall was in the back of me. So I wanted to keep on sketching. Anyway, but then I was going to say about the Vietnam thing. I just tell that one story. That's all. But we were members of Missouri Lutheran Church.
Could you speak a little louder, maybe, so we could hear?
We were members of Missouri Lutheran Church. Thank you. My children went to school there, and we had grade school. I've been on school boards and the whole thing. During those war years, we were already so radicalized by so much was going on and the Vietnam War just irritated, just, it was just another thing that was just coming into our lives. And there was one, I think it was Preuss was the president of Missouri, and he sent around to all the congregations a liturgy. And as one member of the congregation and I, he was an activist more than I was even, but we read the liturgy, and it was going to be recited at the church on Sunday morning. And it just seemed like there wasn't enough in there about recognition of that we were doing something wrong, that there was the forgiveness. It just bothered us no end. So I stayed. I wrote the little prayer. And we were going to interrupt the service. We were going to visit that. And that's what we did. Four of us, Carol and I, another young man, and Ted Glider. Have you ever met Ted Glider? He's a member of the board right now.
I remember, yeah.
Well, he's a member of the board right now. Yeah. He's very active. Yeah.
My board goes back 40 years.
Well, we stood up at the point here in this conservative, and we knew everybody, but and I just trembling, I read this just out loud, and there was just a shocked silence. I never heard anybody. But I tried to counteract some of the things we thought. And the pastor said, Rudy, why didn't you tell me before? Because we walked out of the door. I was shaking. Carol says, when I got home, and we got a couple telephone books, there's a lot of military people in our little congregation because of Fort Myer and Bad Post. And I got this one call just berating me on telephone. She said I fainted, but I don't remember. I never forget that. But, that was really a most moving experience, because just in that conservative congregation stand up, I just was trembling all over.
People got up and walked out.
Some walked out.
If you had said something to the pastor ahead of time, He wouldn't have allowed it.
No, we knew that.
There was nobody.
We loved him. We knew him. We loved everybody.
That's the hard part.
Yeah. That was the hard part, is just to do something real radical.
Lady came up to me afterwards. He says, Carol, how could you do such a thing? I don't understand how you could do it. And I said, well, I'm very glad I did. It was very easy to do.
It wasn't for Rudy. They were hard times.
Yeah.
And it's there a time, of course, where there was so much pain within the community and disagreement, and hopefully we're growing out of that, but only history will tell how much we've really learned as a community. Mm-hmm. Other stories. 50s and the 60s, and they're sure different decades.
In 1950, I had a Pontiac that was straight eight that would accelerate from 0 to 50 miles an hour in 20 seconds. And it would beat a Ford V8. We were in Minneapolis one night, and the abandoned Ford sat right along beside the street light. And I said to Ruby, now when this light changes, I'm going to leave that Ford behind, and then he'll catch me before I get down the street. She said, how do you know that? Well, I knew. I'd read it in the Sports or the Mechanics Illustrated. Mechanics Illustrated, it would do it. So I knew mine was tuned good, so I took off. And then the Ford passed me, and Ruby said, how did you know that? I never will forget that. 1950 was a good year. I had a hot car.
Those were the 50s, Nazi. That was the 50s.
We had an Edsel.
My folks had a Hudson.
That's an Oldsmobile looking like a sour lemon.
my folks had a Hudson. Had Hudsons. Remember the Hudson?
Yeah, we had a Hudson.
Hudson.
That was a great car.
That's a great car.
We also had an Essex earlier.
Oh, an Essex
my
earlier?
My dad had an Essex.
That is earlier, yeah.
That's earlier.
Yeah. That's before the 50s.
Yeah, yep. It was. Long before.
Okay, other things on the 50s and 60s stories.
Yes. Well, when he mentioned Marian Anderson singing at the front of Lincoln Memorial, I heard her sing in February or March before Easter in 58 at Independence Hall.
Oh.
Gave a beautiful concert. She, you know, had such a magnificent voice, and what a singer. I couldn't help but think back of the time when she couldn't sing there, when Eleanor Roosevelt,
yeah.
you know, made the point of resigning from the DDR, and that's when she sang in front of Lincoln Memorial. I don't know what year that was.
Miss Roosevelt was president.
So she wasn't permitted to sing up until when?
Well, I don't know, probably before that, but I did hear in 58, about March or April.
So I mean, you know, it's so strange that within the nation's capital, places where some of the most beautiful singers couldn't sing because of the color of their skin. I mean, it's just hard to believe.
Constitution Hall, that was the only hall.
Constitution. That was the only place in Washington, D.C. at the time where you could have a concert that would hold enough people.
Yeah.
And the DAR refused to let her sing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Constitution.
I don't know if it happened in the 50s, but Dr. Carver, the famous black agriculturist that developed so much on peanuts,
28 separate things,
was asked to come to Washington, D.C. to speak to the House of Representatives. Upon approaching the building, he was directed to go around the freight elevator, which he did, and arrived on the floor of the House. And later somebody asked Dr. Carver, how did you feel about that? And his answer was, it isn't so important how you reach the top, but what's going on in your heart on the way up.
It's an awful lot we can learn from
humbleness.
Yes. Other stories. Yes.
You don't have a black-white problem if you don't have blacks. So in Idaho, we remember 59 is the year of the big earthquake, which is when Yellowstone Park had a big upheaval, and the geysers now have different schedules. And we have a new lake because part of the mountain fell down and buried a campground there.
Wow.
And so 59 is the year of the earthquake, and we didn't much get into demonstrations.
There are a lot of, I was born in the late 40s, and so by the time I was 1960, I was 12, and so it, you know, specific events, either disasters or you know, different things. I can remember coming home in October 1960, and hearing on the. It was just announced that about Bay of Pigs, you know, and it was my parents. That was a very scary, you know, it was a very scary time. You know, I can, you know, then there were other natural disasters. There were, you know, there was a 64 Alaska earthquake. There was the assassination of Kennedy. You know. All these things, you know, it seemed the whole period was just punctuated by disaster or these catastrophic things, and it seemed on those events to, you know, to bring people closer together that may have been separated in some respects, and now they were sitting next to each other, and they knew something was wrong. You know, with the way things were going, I knew something was wrong. And I think, you know, Vietnam, I think about that period because I was a student, you know, I was a student in college, and I think about my choices, how limited my choices were. You know, I had a commitment. I wanted to be a parochial school teacher. But I also had to watch my grades. I had to keep those up. I had to, you know, take so many credits. it wasn't a free choice, you know.
Because you were in the draft.
You were in the draft. I was number 32, you know. And I think I wouldn't have, I wasn't to the point of resisting, you know. I think if it came to a point in the early 70s where, you know, I was told, I was teaching in a parochial school in Ohio, and I was received notice that I was supposed to report for my physical, and my draft board just decided that they didn't want to honor my deferment that I had as at that time was a minister of education or something like that, and they didn't want to honor that. It had to come to for one individual person, you know, I think the president of the Missouri Senate had to write a letter to my draft board saying, yes, this person is involved in this, and this is what he's doing. So I just see it as these events which drew people together, and I also see it myself as my choices really being limited. I can see the 70s now as just a change in the way there is more freedom as far as, you know, there's fewer jobs, but there's more freedom for kids to explore different things. And I think they are exploring different things. But the choices were to go in, to fight it, to, you know, to run off to Canada. So it was a very narrowly defined role that you had to take at that time.
Yeah, there were a lot of catastrophes, it seemed like. I was in New York City during the blackout. And that was a fascinating experience. Right in the middle of New York City, and I remember the lights just kind of flittering, and we were out. I looked out the window, and there wasn't any light anywhere. And if you know New York City. And I went outside, and it was dust. And all these people came out from these buildings that I had never known before. And we began talking. And we began really meeting people. And a few people had portable radios, and I can't get anything from here. We've just heard that Boston is out, Albany, New York is out, Philadelphia is out. Well, for New Yorkers, that's half the world right now. And we were hearing all of these places were out, and people, you know, the thing in their mind was, well, this is a war. I mean, this is somehow, this is the beginning of it. There wasn't any panic, though. And people were closer together. There was almost a relief that this big system that we were caught up in could break down. It was almost a relief, a sense of relief. And I remember seeing the people, and crime rates went down. It was a strange experience. Okay, other experiences from the 50s and 60s.
Well, this was a little bit before the 50s, but I have to tell you about it, because we lived in Inhua. That's a little town, you know, up the bottom of the mountain. And we didn't come into Seattle very often, you know, because that was a pretty long trip in the cars. You know, at that time, the cars weren't too high-powered, but we'd make a trip in once in a while. My little daughter was about 3 years old, and we were going up on an elevator, and of course at that time there weren't many black people out here in the west of it at all, you know. Very seldom you saw one. We were going up this elevator. Oh, I just got the funny feeling we got in this elevator, and I saw this black lady. I thought, oh, something's going to happen here. And my little daughter took her hand out of her pocket. Mother, look at that black lady. Oh, I think if I could have fallen through the elevator, I would have. Oh, that was the worst feeling. Of course, I'm not prejudiced, but I mean, I was afraid maybe, you know, she'd really say something. But anyway, she stooped down and I said to Norma, I said, "Can you be quiet?" And of course, I had to get off the elevator. I tried to explain to her, you know. But it was very, very frightful for the kids to see black people when they'd never seen one, you know.
Imagine how the blacks must have felt, though.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, if all of a sudden you woke up and you're in a community of all blacks.
Yeah.
Looking back, I don't remember what year, but you remember when Jackie Robinson broke into the Brooklyn Dodgers?
Oh yeah, Brooklyn. Well, yeah, that's my favorite team.
The Cardinals would not take the field for over a half an hour because there was a colored man on the baseball team. Now take a look at our athletic teams and colleges and our professional teams. If you didn't have the blacks, you wouldn't have much. And we kind of accept him. Look at Hank Aaron when he did broke the home run record. Nobody felt bad because he was black and won it.
No,
I think a stupendous movement that we've made. You know, even though it has been painful for the blacks, we've certainly come a long ways.
I think the point some of the black leaders are raising now is they want to see the role models in all professions, because quite often, that one of the reasons there are so many blacks in there because they see that as the role model, and the attrition rate is horrible in terms of athletics. The number that actually make it is so small compared to the number that try. And so this is one of the reasons why the black community now is saying, look, on the television shows, have black doctors, nurses, teachers, the whole, you know, the whole spectrum, gangsters, the whole, you know, the whole spectrum. Not that they want them to be gangsters, but not to just single out the singer and the athlete. And they've been making that.
While we're doing that, we got to bring along the forgotten American, the Indian, and we've got to bring along the Chicano too.
Oh.
See, and another thing, we've got to educate our black friends too, that the whites are not entirely all responsible for the slavery. Because if we didn't run our gangplanks over there, and they run up joyfully up the gangplank, you know, there had to be some corrupt blacks over there willing to sell their brothers, or we would never have slavery in North America. And I think that point has to be gotten across to the blacks as well.
Well, I think, you know, the book Roots, I think, makes that point. I think that, you know, if you know, the television series that, I think the black, for so long, the blacks were saying, let's just have any blacks in history, the good, the bad, let's, you know, we don't want to pick up a history book and it's all whites except the slaves. And I think it's healthier. Because I think, you know, anyhow, let's go on stories, personal stories.
I can tell you about the first time I ran into integration. I went, a little country boy from North Dakota, and went down to St. Louis, and all of a sudden I realized that we had streetcars that operated with a black sat in the rear. We had restrooms where blacks went and whites did not. You walked down a street and there were three blacks and one white, and the black stepped out the street. You know, I've been down there about a month or two, and you know, I almost got to the point where I thought maybe that's the way it should be.
Yeah, you begin to get
used to it. And I hated myself for doing it.
That's
and
right.
And I look back on it.
Yeah.
And I wonder whatever came over me to make me think that was right.
That's right. That's right.
I was 21 years old at the time.
That's right. There's and so many things like that. Yeah. And that's a good example where we just... We come to accept it until we're hit in the head, and we all of a sudden we see it. We say, how could we? And we're ashamed. Yeah.
But I think it's good to remember that those things did happen.
That's right.
Because there is this movement of the Klan.
That's right.
And the Klan is still active in the South.
Yeah.
And they're gaining some members in the North. I don't know how powerful they are, but they are still pulling their raw deals on people. So it's good to remember.
That's good to remember that.
We got to be careful we don't get anti-Jewish again, too. What's the Klan stand for?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. We've got to stand up for our brothers and sisters all over, regardless. And if we don't, then we know how terrible it can get. I mean, this century has the history to show that.
And I think of the Japanese that were discriminated against during World War II.
Yeah. And it's a different kind of discrimination. We were in Norway in 1962. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And taking one of these tour trips, you know, that travelers do, and somebody mentioned to us that there was a German doctor and his wife on the upper deck, and everybody was shunning them. And we do talk around a little bit in the comments. because of what the Germans had done to Norway, the Norwegians still couldn't be comfortable with the Germans.
Whoa,
62. So, I spoke, that was 10 years, almost 20 years. So I speak enough German that I can get along, so I'll have an eye with it.
72.
It's a good story.
It's a better story. 82 would be even better.
Wrong year. Wrong day.
That's all right.
You still have to finish the story. And so we went up and talked with them for an hour, hour and a half, and found out that they were Nazi resistors.
Oh.
And he was a pediatrician, and two or three times his office had been completely destroyed by the Nazis because he insisted on treating people as they came. He should have been viewed as a hero.
Yeah.
I think another, as far as prejudice, another thing that we've kind of overcome over many years, that my grandparents, old Germans, that just thought Catholics were there. My grandparents, they just Catholics were just on the other end of the scale.
When I grew up, I thought maybe Catholics might have had horns. I wasn't sure.
But I guess even the Klan had that as part of the prison.
Yeah.
Religious.
Oh, yeah.
But my goodness, that's a change.
But our Catholic brothers have gone a long ways too. At one time they were taught not to, there wasn't any Christians only within their church, and now they've come along.
That's true. Yes, yeah, so it was Pope John. Pope John in the 60s. He was in the 60s, right?
That's right.
And he had, he was a person, you know, that people just loved, you know? And people who were against the Catholics all their life, here was this man who was just, he was a lovable person.
There's a lot of people like the Pope we have now, real well. They can reach out to him for his stand against communism.
I think, if I remember correctly, Pope John referred to Protestants as separated brethren.
Yeah. Yeah, he just...
Which was quite a brethren. Concession.
Yeah, oh yes.
Quite a concession.
He was an amazing person. He was an amazing person.
That's something to hear, the untested worthy sense of God in the Catholic community.
Okay, other stories.
I remember being 7 years old and trudging through the snow to our closest neighbor a half a mile away who had a television so we could watch National Velvet.
Wow.
That's, you know, I think TV, again, I grew up with TV. And it was, I can remember from the small, you know, we had a small set, and it was important. And I, you know, I was thinking back, and they're bringing back the old shows, and it's, I was looking at the quality and the other day, and even a show like Gilligan's Island of the 1960s has almost a better quality than half the shows right now, and I was talking with some friends about cartoons, and the cartoons of the 50s and 60s were characters that you could almost identify with. You had Crusader Rabbit, and you had Bullwinkle Moose, and it was a very highbrow. It was almost a cartoon for
highbrow,
a cartoon for adults. You know, they had fractured the poems and things like that. And the cartoons you have now, you've got inanimate objects running around. They make cartoons about anything. They have cartoons about Pac-Man and Donkey Kong. You know, and quickly, not only do they become cartoon figures, these arcade things, but then now they're serials. You know, it's so easy to see this. It's just, who can identify with Pac-Man? You know, there's just nothing to it. And I see those cartoon people, and they're real. They're more real to me than what's going on right now.
Well, I was raised on the radio, And I was maybe the last generation to make it. Remember some of the old radio shows?
Amos and Andy.
Amos and Andy.
We always had listened to them by an old-fashioned radio.
Baby Snooks.
Yeah,
Tom Mix. Oh, that was my favorite. It was Tom Mix.
You beat me and my mommy and I beat a mean little kid. Yeah. Red Skull?
Yeah, Red Skull.
Yeah. Me and my mommy and I beat a mean little kid.
Outside of country music or bluegrass music, the music that was different in those days too, you could recognize a tune.
Yeah.
Melody was part of the composition.
Of course, I remember every generation saying that, and I have to tell one story. They were, I think it was Orson Welles or something. He came up and he said, "Well, the new generation now, the words are terrible and all of this," and so he was going to read the poetry from the music of the older generation as poetry, as Orson Welles, and some of the words, and he went way back, he covered all our generation, some of the words were so terrible and so silly, but he read this in this very serious. So, okay, other stories.
Sputnik, what year did it come out?
Sputnik?
Revolutionized everything.
57, I think.
Now, boy, when I saw that tumble up in the sky, I thought that was really something.
Yes, Sputnik was in 57. That was a big change.
Big change. We had to really do something. I don't know where we ever got the idea. You know, as individuals, we learned that we can't be all superior. I don't know where we ever got the idea that we had to corner in all the world's brains either. That kind of taught us that should have taught us something that we didn't have then.
Well, in the 50s, I think that was kind of, you know, we came out of World War II, we were the most powerful country in the world. And the 50s were unacceptable, you know, tremendous economic growth. And it was, you know, so we did have that sense.
I know they said at the time Khrushchev set up a talking dog, and he said, "Well, what does the dog say?" And he said, "It's rough."
I remember in the 50s in school having to air raid practice and diving under the desks doing that as if that was going to help you. An atomic bomb. Yeah.
Well, then we had to have the air raid shelters and survival kits.
Yeah. And the blackout.
In the 60s, we built a children's center outside of Chicago, and we had to equip our basement as an air raid shelter to get a building permit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now we withstood a decent conventional bomb, to say nothing of an atomic bomb, but you know.
Was it an air raid shelter?
That was
shelter
part of the mood of the time.
A civil defense place where you could go for protection.
Yeah. Then you have to learn civil defense to go through all that.
It's not a direct protection.
It's the Second World War that started the downgrade too. That was a war that was bad for this country.
It was bad for. I'm not sure whether there were any of them that were good for us.
No, but I mean, it seemed to be worse. From what I can remember.
Well, the Korean War was going on in the early 50s.
The Korean War in 53?
Yeah.
53. And then the McCarthy period. Any stories from the McCarthy period?
That's a radio. I remember radio.
Because communist under every chair.
Yeah, I can remember back in Sheridan, Wyoming in 1954. There was a dentist there at the Veterans Hospital. And he was just a really fine man, very active in the community and active in various Christian things. And all of a sudden we heard that he was a communist, that McCarthy's committee had named him as a communist. And everybody became very frightened. Nobody would invite him to their parties anymore. And everybody didn't want to even stop and talk to them on the street. It was really quite frightening to see what happened. Very quickly, they became shunned, and
he was put on suspension from his job at the hospital, and then for about 3 or 4 months he was under investigation, and it was really disheartening to see that people didn't rally around, and we didn't know him, but you know, in a small town like that, you tried to keep some communication. Then lo and behold, they discovered that his mother had taken out a life insurance policy on his life, one of those, you know, where you pay $2 a week or something, to a Polish insurance company, paternal insurance company, and that insurance company had been labeled a front for communist activities. Mm-hmm. And anybody who had a policy with that company was put on the suspect list. And on that basis, he was out of work for about 8 months and nobody talked to him.
Oh, okay.
It was that paranoia, I think, that really set the stage for the mistakes that led to Vietnam, I think. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you start up in one decade thinking one way, and you know, you start the machinery going for seeing the world that way, and we got involved in Vietnam without studying the history of those countries, and we just saw it as communism versus non-communism. And
I had a personal experience in that myself, and to me it was a thing of delay, it could have been serious. But I remember in Washington, a bookstore, a second floor building opened up, it was called a cooperative bookstore, and I wandered in there a number of times, and they had books that I'd never seen before. But I was interested in architecture, and I went to several lectures on Buckminster Fuller, even. Sponsored by this, and so I took out a dollar membership. I got a little card. I got paid a dollar, and I got a little card that I could get books at a cheaper rate, and so on. And when I enlisted in the Navy, I was on record. Along with the property, it was on the list. It was on the list as I kind of said that sold, probably had Marxist books and things on it. Now you see them everywhere, but in those days, boy. And then I was able to enlist, but I had to make a statement, so in front of a board. And then when I tried to get my job back, even in agriculture, after I got out of the Navy, I had to appear before a board too, to kind of explain my association to this bookstore. Just several months membership practically.
Yeah. I hope we've learned something from those experiences as
I'm
a culture.
I'm not so sure. The way that there are the Ku Klux Klan coming down, there are evidences of McCarthyism rising. Our Central America could be a repeat of Vietnam. I'm not sure history has taught us too many.
Now I hear rumblings around that we're letting all the Asiatics come in the Seattle area and get all the jobs.
Oh, yeah. Because the jobs nobody else wanted, but that's different.
Well, that's beside the point. They got the job.
Prejudice against the Asians and the Chicanos is worse.
Well, it seems a little different now in the sense I do see people scrambling for jobs. Mm-hmm. I saw the prejudice that I experienced in the 50s more. It was just, you could have the person, the most secure person in the world, and they'd label them right off the bat. There was a prejudice there. There was a certain pain associated now with people searching for jobs, trying to blame. There's another injustice there that's got a different dimension to it. Hopefully we don't go back to the racism, you know, pure racism. Hopefully not. But I think it is important to remember the history that people speak and that they see. Other stories, yeah.
I remember as a kid getting up early in the morning on a number of mornings and watching space flights go off from Cape Canaveral in Florida, and on this coast it was always about 3 a.m. when you had to get up and do it. That was a big adventure for a little kid.
It was a blooming of technology in the 60s.
And it was no routine for my generation, and I imagine for older people it was a real amazing thing, but I got pretty jaded.
these stories?
Well, you're talking about film, TV in its early days. And, a friend of mine said, I think it was her mother. She didn't, because she didn't understand how, we don't understand how it works, but her mother would always get dressed up when she was going to watch TV because she thought, if she could see that,
yeah, in the old days too, you with the old radios, you'd take each one and have to have his own turn with his ear.
Yeah.
You know, so we'd sit around the whole family and send the ear sets from one to the other and listen for a little bit. You didn't really get anything out of it. Everybody was listening. Oh, that was something.
That was something. Yeah.
We had a friend that used to pick up the tape to church. She was a Hungarian, a woman who came over later life. But she was just a professional cook. She worked for families and so on. But she had a daughter in our area there, and she lived alone. But she was a wonderful woman. But she was just a rugged individualist. And when Sputnik went up, she said, she wouldn't believe it at all, because the Russians are just stupid all the way down the line. They just couldn't conceive anything like that. They're just no good. They're just, you know.
Wouldn't accept it.
It wasn't up there.
Yeah. Someone else.
I can remember my dad used to have on Easter, used to have a German service for people, and it would be advertised, and then after they have a breakfast, and these people were sitting at this table, and they'd come up, this is in Seattle, they'd come from all over the city to attend this service. There may be about 50 or 60 people, and they were sitting there, and all of a sudden these people looked across the table, and they just got up and started screaming, and they had recognized these people because they had crawled under the barbed wire from, you know, at the end of the war to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't seen these people, and at that point it had been over 15 years, you know, so it was an emotional experience for them.
Many of the modern day medicines haven't been put into use at that time.
Antibiotics, yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I think it was, however, in the late 40s when penicillin was
right.
Begun. I know I was off in India at the time, and we lost a missionary at that time because he had a ruptured appendix, and we didn't have the medicines we should have had.
Yeah, my mother died at that time.
Hmm.
Polio vaccines.
And antibiotics would have, this is just kind of infections now that would be considered, this of course was in the 40s, but infections that would have been considered minor now, people died from. Yeah, polio, remember?
And you remember eating the sugar cubes with polio?
I remember getting the shots. I could, you know, you have a smell of, you're walking to school and having this smell of alcohol, rubbing alcohol, and you get this, your stomach just would knot up.
I remember them telling not to go to the pools on certain days. Remember that? Because of the polio?
Or running through sprinklers. They used to say some mysterious way to get polio from running through sprinklers.
Yeah, it was because parents were just terrified.
Yes.
You know, they were trying so desperately to protect their children, because once they got it, they didn't know what to do. So I can remember parents going through just all kinds of fearful routines, almost as if they were trying to keep away the evil spirits because they were so frightened of polio.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in the days when we invited people to our homes for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go out to eat at all.
Fast food.
Front porches. There were more front porches.
And swings on the porches.
Swings.
Porch swings.
Porch swings, yes. I had a porch swing.
Yeah, if you want to get a conversation started, just say the good old days. Let me be set to firecracker.
Some things were good, some weren't.
Yeah, and I think that's why we need to tell the stories, because there were good things, and there were bad things.
We didn't have much, but we were happy.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, we lost our desire of a work ethic, and this is why we have this prejudice against these Asiatics that come over and take these undesirable jobs. They're willing to work. Some of us have gotten soft along the way and no longer want to soil our hands. We don't want to sweat for 8 hours a day. We only want to work for 6 and get paid for 8. Mm-hmm. All these other little benefits came in, you see, and we consider granted, and it's never a guarantee. We shouldn't have always had to work. We kind of lost our work ethic and our pride in doing things right.
When you speak about polio, we have a neighbor in our hometown that had polio when she was a young married mother and lost the use of her arms and hands, very little that she could use, and I think she used a fulcrum in some cases, but really very little. And she had a lot of frustration. So there was an article in the Better Homes and Gardens magazine. Is that one?
Family Circle.
Family Circle.
August 23rd, Family Circle.
She remembers dates better than I do. But at any rate, it told about the frustrations and experiences that she had as a person over the years, and also her husband had discouragements that with her. And through Camp Courage, she was later able to become more involved and is now driving a car and is very actively involved in speaking to people about the disabilities that she has and how they can possibly overcome or live with the disabilities that they have. And it's quite a fantastic story, I think.
Well, good. Yeah. Some good stories. Other stories.
If you can take another story on race matters, it must have been in the early 60s. We had on Memorial Day, we lived on a corner house in this town of Illinois, which we talked about. And we had invited one of our friends in this family, black pastor, over for the day, and some other poor folks from the inner city. And nobody said anything. But we noticed that 4th of July, there was immediately a neighborhood party to which we were invited. I think they were afraid that we might invite the neighborhood party to tell very quickly after Memorial Day.
We had a cookout, you know.
Beside our patio in the backyard, the corner house. And Bill Griffin insisted on eating some watermelon. Just to play the stereotype. But the neighborhood reaction was subtle, but very, very obvious.
Well, that's learning. Well, I think we see from the history, you know, we see good times, the porches, and the, like you say, inviting people over for dinner and taking time with them. We see the bad times, too, the racism and the prejudice, our narrow-mindedness, and the war that resulted. And I guess that's the kind of freedom we have to experience in a Christian community, to be able to go back and see the good and the bad, and even tell stories that maybe we're ashamed of because we were so naive and something like when you were talking about the racism. Because that's how we go to the future. I think it was Walt Weimer last week he was here, and he said a blessing is when an older person tells a story to a younger person so that the past can be seen in the now and extended into the future. Something like that. He said it much better. And I think we can see this right in here. The stories that we tell and the experiences, good ones, bad ones too, we've got to tell those stories. We've got to tell those stories in a sharing community. And the one thing about the Christian community, because of grace, we can tell those, and whether we're ashamed of them or what, we can learn from them. And I think that's what grace is all about. And whether we were right back then or we are wrong, we don't. That doesn't matter. That's not the issue. We're a growing community and a caring community, and that's what's important.